Protégé Podcast, the career advice, inspiration, and truth you need for your career journey.
Hi, my name is Jordan. You should listen to my dad's podcast. Bye.
I'm Rory Verrett. Welcome to Protégé Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. This is part two of my conversation with Melanie Newman, the crisis communications expert who's been a witness to so much history. On part two of our conversation, Melanie talks about her time in the Obama administration and working alongside some of the most important cabinet members for the president. And on the breakdown, we talk about what we can learn from Melanie's career and how we can apply it on our own career journeys.
I'll tell you a story. There are different color badges. Mm-hmm. And so there's one badge that gets you into the office building, the executive office building, where most White House staff work. Mm-hmm. And if you have that badge, you need another person to escort you through the West Wing and the East Wing and through the White House. Mm. There's another color badge that gets you full access, basically. Mm-hmm. I had the full access badge.
Ooh-wee.
And it never, ever got... I never got over the fact that I could walk around freely in the White House. I always felt like I was going to get caught. And there were times. So
right.
Because I had this all access badge, I could invite friends. I also had mess privileges. So the White House mess is the dining room in the White House. Mm-hmm. And you can bring your family and friends to eat a meal, breakfast or lunch. You can also get carry out. So almost every day I ate food from the mess. You can go there to get drinks or tea, whatever. So I had some friends come over for lunch, and we ate lunch in the mess. And I mm-hmm. said, you know, I'll walk you out through the East Wing so you can get like a cursory tour of the East Wing. Mm-hmm. So we are walking, and you sort of walk through the Rose Garden mm-hmm. where the president has his press conferences outdoors, and there's a door to his office right off the Rose Garden. Mm-hmm. But if you walk down the walkway through the Rose Garden, that's what takes you into the other side of the White House, which is called the East Wing. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. you can exit that and be on the side of the Treasury Department and just be outside of the complex. And so I would take people out that way so they could feel like they saw other parts of the White House. I'm certain that that's frowned upon. Mm-hmm. It's frowned upon. It's not common. You're probably not supposed to do that. But I would do it because... how many of us are going to get this chance again? How many of us are going to get to do this?
Let me state for the record that I was one of those people that had lunch with you in the mess. And we did a full-on tour. And I'm sitting there. I mean, people that follow me on Facebook, those pictures of me in the White House goofing off at the press podium. That is the presidential podium. I am goofing off. Melanie is rolling her eyes on the side while she takes a picture of me. So that was my secret source is Melanie Newman. And furthermore, when we left the White House, we're walking outside and you're like, stay still, stay still. I'm like, what? You're like, just stay still. And an SUV comes charging up, screeches to a halt, and then out tumbles John Kerry. Hey, how's it going? Good to see you. I'm like, what?
And John- well, so that's a good example of the things that happened. This particular day, I had two girlfriends with me. We walk toward the Rose Garden, and I see that there's a collection of Secret Service. And I said, is somebody moving? Because if the president or the first lady or the vice president move, they usually stop traffic and they'll make you hold wherever you are. So I asked multiple people, is somebody moving? And no one answered me. So I kept going.
Uh-oh.
And we walk out to the Rose Garden, and the president of the United States walks out of his office and is walking behind me. And I said to my friends, the president is behind us. And they said, what president? And I said, the president of the United States. I'm going to get fired because I'm not supposed to be here. This is terrible. And so we get through the doors into the next building. And I said, just stop. We're just going to stop and stand here. And he will walk past us. And we are going to turn around and go back. We're not doing the East Wing. That's not happening.
Oh,
we're going back.
Goodness.
You're going out the way you came. I'm sorry. But you got to see the president today. So he walks past us and he says, hey, guys, how's it going?
What?
And nobody said anything because we are terrified. My knees are shaking. I'm literally going to get fired. These people aren't supposed to be here.
Oh, goodness.
But he was totally cool. We went back and I was like hyperventilating. It was never mm-hmm. not cool to me mm-hmm. to work in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
On my last day, I don't think I turned my badge until like 9:30 at night because I didn't want to leave. Like I knew I wanted this new job, but I wasn't going to be able to run around freely like this.
I have spoken. I had a dinner set up with some departing White House staffers, and we were talking about, you know, career advice and how to think about their careers. And without sort of throwing cold water on the moment, I said sort of like, it's not all downhill from here, but this is a special moment. When you look back on the long arc of your career, having a boss that you believe in, and you've had quite a few that are people, most folks would have one of them and be happy. I mean, Loretta Lynch, Sean Donovan, and he was the HUD secretary and then became the budget director, the head of the Office of Management and Budget, and you worked for him. Tell me about what that was like.
So Sean Donovan, he tells people that when they called him to talk to him about coming on as HUD secretary, they told him he was the seventh choice.
Oh, my goodness.
He was the former housing director for the city of New York. And he had worked at HUD in the Clinton administration.
Mm-hmm.
He had been the deputy assistant secretary for housing. He knew how the building worked. He knew really smart people. You know Fred Tumbar,
mm-hmm.
who went to St. Aug with you.
Mm-hmm.
My first day at HUD, I show up, I get in the elevator with the guy, and we're both going in the same direction. I tell him I'm Melanie Russo. He said, "You're Norman's little sister." Because I cannot escape, no matter how old I get or where I go, being Norman's little sister.
Here, here. I'm in the same boat.
They had gone to grad school together. He knew, he brought on a bunch of really smart and talented people because that was what we were going to need to address that foreclosure crisis. And, you know, HUD had been up to that point, the backwater of the federal government. Nobody took the HUD secretary seriously.
Mm-hmm.
The HUD secretary rarely, you know, people are making fun of this Ben Carson pick, but the HUD secretaries traditionally had, not traditionally, there are a few exceptions, Jack Kemp, Cuomo,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There are some exceptions, Moon Landrieu, but it was common for the HUD secretary to be a political appointment,
mm-hmm.
a strictly political appointment, not someone who had any experience in the area of housing or urban development.
Mm-hmm.
But Sean Donovan had been doing it for years and really, really put the pedal to the metal in addressing the crisis and bringing financial stability to the FHA, which is how low and middle income people have been able to get housing loans.
Mm-hmm.
Many people buy their first houses with FHA loans, and the FHA was in a crisis in 2009 and could have been shut down by Congress if not for the work of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And you know, he's not a flashy guy. He's not seeking out all the credit, but he deserves it because he's done incredible work. And then he's been head of the Office of Management and Budget since
mm-hmm.
2014.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And has worked through several appropriations crises when the government was threatened to be shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been holding it together, and he worked to get a 2-year budget deal out of Congress. And so,
right.
Underrated.
So,
but that's my guy. I like that guy.
So specific to you, I mean, mm-hmm. you've described him as a great housing leader and public servant and innovative, but specific to you, how do you define him as a great boss? What did he do?
He told me once, very early on, so I was the first political appointee hired in the public affairs office at HUD. I started mm-hmm. the first week in February.
Mm-hmm.
And I was briefing him on something, on an interview or something, and he said, I need you to give me real feedback. I don't want you to tell me what I did right. I want you to tell me what I did wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's all he had to say to me, because I am like the most brutally honest person. I just didn't know him that well, and I didn't want to put him off. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we came to have this relationship where I would tell him, that was really bad. Don't ever say that again. You got to stop telling the story. Mm. I am the butt of jokes and speeches now, because he tells stories that I have told him not to tell anymore, because they're old. And when he tells them, he says, Melanie doesn't want me to tell you this, but, you know, we came to be friends. He came to my wedding, but it's because we had this honest relationship where I was able to give him honest feedback. There aren't a lot of people in high places in politics who want to be told the truth. Mm.
That is so true. It's rare. It's the exception rather than the rule that your boss, somebody that reports to the president, is going to actually say, give me advice, and then actually use it and take it.
Exactly. Most people want to be told they're great. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what they did well. Mm-hmm. And how well they always do. That was not what he wanted. He wanted to improve. He was always trying to find ways to be better. Mm.
That's awesome. And that's a rare experience, I'm telling you.
And from a communication standpoint, you know, William Jefferson listened to me because I don't know why. He had known me since I was a child. I don't know if I would have listened to me, because I was 12 years old when I was working for him. But he had known me. He trusted me. Mm-hmm. Sean Donovan didn't know me at all. He did, you know, ask me in my interview, what did I know about crisis communications? Because HUD was a crisis agency. Mm-hmm. And I laughed at him.
How and much said, time do you have, Mrs. Secretary?
Well, no, I just said I worked for William Jefferson. You may know him. He's going on trial soon for the federal investigation. And he said, oh, okay. No more questions.
Yes, next question, please.
So that is how I've answered that question in the past. What do you know about, I've gotten it in interviews since then. What do you know about crisis communications? I worked for William Jefferson, and that usually ends the discussion.
Yeah. And then you go to work for Attorney General Loretta Lynch, your soror, Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated, the first Black woman attorney general. And there was a whole lot of expectation, particularly among African Americans and progressives, that she would continue sort of the tone and tenor that Eric Holder had at the Justice Department. What was it like working with Attorney General Loretta Lynch?
Fascinating, amazing. I remember sitting in meetings with her and just like hoping that her demeanor and the way she operated would rub off on me, because I may have a lot of good qualities, but she has a way of being very direct and clear about what she wants. Mm-hmm. And it could be the opposite of what you want. Mm-hmm. But somehow when you receive it, you somehow believe that it was also what you want. her understanding and her background is fascinating also. And her work and the way she works and the way she thinks about cases and the way she thinks about evidence. And she's been doing this a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, she was the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York twice during the Clinton administration and the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. She has a storied career as a prosecutor in New York. She did the Louima case. Mm-hmm. In New York. So she is familiar with the issues of policing and has prosecuted police in like a very high profile case. And so to be working for her at that time was an incredible opportunity. And she's also just a really nice person and the most polite woman you'll ever meet.
Yes.
she's amazing to work for. And so it was an amazing opportunity. I think the time when she was sworn in, maybe the day before Baltimore went up in flames.
Mm.
And so the timing of her tenure, Baltimore was on fire. You have the Charleston shooting.
Mm-hmm.
You have, I think the first 2 or 3 months I was there, there were multiple mass shootings in Lafayette. And I honestly can't, there were so many that I can't remember them all.
Mm-hmm.
Multiple terrorist attacks. You had Paris, Brussels, San Bernardino, and then Orlando. And so not only on the issue of policing, there are all these national security issues popping up, all of these mass shootings, these people who go into a place and just shoot it up,
mm-hmm.
happening around the country. And you have this woman who is 5'3", she says, but I think it's probably 5'1", who can stand before a podium and calm the room immediately.
Mm-hmm. She has a quiet, steely focus and calm about her. When you meet her, it's just some people have an aura about themselves that gives you a quiet but purposeful confidence. And she has that in so many ways.
Absolutely. And then she can also very calmly, you know, flip tables if needed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when she announced the lawsuit against North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
her remarks and the way she delivered them was like one of the most classic speeches of her tenure, mm-hmm. and one that certainly will go down in history, because she spoke to the LGBT community in a way that not many people do on that day. And it was a very strong statement to her home state,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
a strong statement of defiance. There were many points over her tenure that I was present for where I could not have been more proud of the work we were doing and the work that she was doing and being a part of that process to drive her passion and translate her passion into a narrative for the department was incredible.
And do you think your status as a Black woman covering and engaging with the media and external stakeholders on some of these police misconduct cases, do you think that you brought a special emphasis or a special attention to these issues as a communications executive? And how did that play out?
I don't know if I always did, but I remember over the past summer after the Alton Sterling and Philando Castile shootings, I was pregnant with a baby boy, and talking to the reporters who were on the Justice Department beat, you know, they'd say, man, this is really terrible. I can't believe this. And I said, yeah, it's really terrible as I carry this Black boy that I'm going to deliver into this world.
Mm.
It is very terrible and it's scary and horrifying. And to see their faces change,
mm-hmm.
and how they think about it change, they sort of know that is something people experience, but they may not know personally anyone who experiences it. And so, I never did it on purpose. That was what I was feeling in the moment,
mm-hmm.
and I have trouble containing those things. And mm-hmm. so it was never intentional, but I certainly think it was a different experience for the reporters because there had never been anyone who looked like me in that seat.
Mm-hmm.
in my job. And mm-hmm. there had never been anyone who looked like me carrying a Black boy at this time in history to bring it full circle for them in the moment.
Wow. That's deep. And your boss is the first African-American woman attorney general working for the first African-American president. All of that
history
is relevant for how you embrace some of these policy issues.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I think reporters would ask her if she felt differently or if she approached the issue differently as an African-American woman. And she would never really address that question because mm-hmm. it, I think it, it, it suggests a lack of humanity in everyone else. Well, that you can only really address these issues if you are personally impacted by it.
Yeah.
And she wanted to make the point that we should all be appalled.
Right. And it's also kind of a trick question from some reporters, because what they are trying to ask is, are you more sensitive to these issues because the victims are Black? Are you more focused on these police misconduct cases when the victims are Black, or when, you know, the police officer is not Black? And, you know, that's kind of a trick question. I think her approach of we should all feel empathy no matter who the victim is.
Right.
I mean,
and the yeah. president got that a lot, too.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no easy answer. There's no winning answer. When after the Trayvon Martin shooting, he said Trayvon Martin could have been my son. He was criticized for that.
Right. But he also cried publicly about Sandy Hook. And most of those kids, not all of them, were white. And he's sitting there crying, saying, the thing that really bothers me, the area where I wish I had made more of an impact, is on gun control, and it makes me mad and sad when I think about Sandy Hook. And those are suburban white kids. Sandy Hook shook me up. I had a six-year-old daughter in first grade. I'm like, those parents are showing up at Sandy Hook waiting for their child, and some of them are not going to get their child running out of the building. And it didn't matter that the kids were Black or white or Asian. It didn't matter. They were kids like my daughter. And so
exactly.
If we can't see Alton Sterling thinking, wow, that's a guy just, you know, hanging outside the store. There are white people and white women and Indian and Asian people who hang outside of stores all around America. If you can't see him as somebody like you or somebody in your family, then that's a deficit on your side. So, Melanie, I want to ask you some career-focused questions. What would you tell the 30-year-old version of yourself about your career based on what you know now?
That's a good question. I would tell the 30-year-old version of myself to take it all in,
mm-hmm.
and to stop thinking about what you're going to do when you leave the administration. So I've been in the administration now essentially the entire 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
But when I started, I turned 30 in 2009. I was thinking, I'll do this for 2 years or so, and then I'm going to go into the private sector and do something. And 2 years later, I did leave the administration, but I went to work on the reelection campaign, the 2012 reelection campaign. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the campaign, I thought, I'm not going to go back into the administration. I have this great opportunity to exit. I just did this national. I've been doing TV. I can do something different. I was right to stay in the administration and to come or to go back into the administration, because the work that we have been able to accomplish and being a part of it and being mm-hmm. in the room for this history and these conversations, that you won't get that anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think I was always thinking about what I was going to do when it was over,
mm-hmm.
and not always. It wasn't until the end, maybe when I was working at OMB and I was in the White House, where I was like really drinking it all in, mm-hmm. and really appreciating being here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because nothing gold can stay, as the poem says, and
that's right.
Everything changes and you move on. I was speaking with somebody today, a White House staffer, giving some career advice. And I said, with the few moments you have left, take it all in, like, and journal this stuff, because you'll lose some nuance 2 years from now. You get into your new job and there'll be a new administration. And look, when that helicopter picks the first family up and they go off, you know, it's the end of an era. And so journal this stuff, capture it, write it down.
That's another thing I would say.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I had.
Mm-hmm.
I have a fairly good memory, but since I just had a baby, that's it's deteriorating. And I really wish I had written more things down. I remember a lot about my career, but there are days where I think I was, you know, I was in the room for very important conversations and I didn't write it down. And so that's also a very important point.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of it is captured here on Protégé Podcast for posterity. Digital media can't die, so it'll be around. I also want to ask you, your career and your function and profession is, you know, glamorized in the media and Olivia Pope and all this kind of stuff. What does it really take to do crisis communications well? To somebody that wants to have a career like yours, what are some traits and skills that are required to do it at a high level?
Creativity,
mm-hmm.
certainly. Being able to think on your feet, ways in which to influence narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be able to be creative, a sense of calm. So on a normal day, I'm not the calmest person alive. Anyone will tell you that. But for some reason, in the middle of a crisis, I am like calm, cool, and collected.
Mm-hmm.
And I am, again, I think you need the person. You need to be the person in the room that has it together. That is the most authentic thing about the Olivia Pope character on Scandal, is that everyone else may be freaking out and Olivia Pope is thinking.
Okay. But how do you remain calm? I mean, are you just naturally, does your blood pressure go down? You do, you know, Zen-like breathing exercises? I mean, how is it you become so calm when everybody else is losing their minds?
You can't think when you're losing your mind. I have to think, so I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking keeps me calm.
As opposed to reacting.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You have to think first before you react. Mm-hmm. And so I have to think through what's actually happening, what I think will happen, what are the different directions this could take, and how can I influence the directions that this can take.
Mm-hmm. All right, Melanie, a crazy question. If you had to think about a movie that most reflected your career, which character and what movie would you pick?
I kind of feel like it would be Forrest Gump, because I kept ending up in the room for history or in mm-hmm. as part of the story and not always intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few occasions in my career where I ran to the fire, but more often than not, I was there and something happened.
Right.
We didn't even get to talk about when I got sent to New Orleans to help the team that was responding to the BP oil spill. I mean, I have popped up like Forrest Gump did in more than a number of historical moments over the last 15 years. And so you say I'm Olivia Pope, and I think I'm a little Olivia Pope, a little Forrest Gump.
Well, I think careers are made by the moments that your skills intersect in terms of history and time. If you think about the rest of your career, imagine what's next if this is the appetizer. It's amazing.
It is amazing, but as you noted, for those of us who work in the White House, it's probably all downhill from here.
Careful with that. I'm telling you, you may have some magical element about you that just attracts history to, you know, where you are. It may just be the opposite. But it's certainly something that when you think about the portfolio of experiences you can talk about, I'm in some ways a professional interviewer. And I tell people your interview is the most important part of your job search process. And the most important part of a great interview is great storytelling. And great storytelling is based on great moments. And boy, you've got at least five that could, that could fill up an interview and just have the person riveted, because beyond what you've done, understanding what exactly happened in those moments, BP oil crisis, some of the police misconduct cases, Katrina, Bill Jefferson was front page news when he was being investigated. The Obama White House in the last years. I mean, you were there as a staffer to turn the lights out. And you know, what was going on in the White House when, you know, Hillary Clinton didn't win. I mean, that's its own sort of story.
Yeah, it's been an incredible journey, and I'm just blessed and really grateful for the opportunities.
What's next? I know you're a new mom. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And tell us what's on your plate. What are you thinking about doing at this next stage of your career?
I am thinking about raising my baby. I honestly don't know. I don't know. I've been having some conversations, as everyone is. It's a difficult time in Washington because everyone is unemployed.
Yes.
And when I tell my friends who don't live in Washington that, they're like shocked. And my response is, elections have consequences.
Yep.
And this is one of them.
Huge.
And, you know, that happened in 2008 as well. Mm-hmm. Every Republican in Washington was then unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
That is sort of the nature of the city and of the work that we do. It is fully dependent on elections. And so it's a difficult time. I am talking to different people, trying to figure out what's next for me. If I want to continue being the crisis communications person, or do I want to try something different? I'm also trying to help younger people get jobs where I can. I've been here a long time. I have a lot of contacts. I have networks, and I want to help them find a place because their networks aren't as deep and as broad as mine might be. So I'm spending a lot of time talking to young people, trying to figure out what they want to do and how I can be helpful.
Melanie, thank you so much for sharing so many of these testimonies from these moments in history. I mean, it's like a political science course in what is still a very early part of your career. There's so much left in your career. So I know Scandal isn't based on your life, but if they ever make a show about a powerhouse communications executive who deals with indictments and natural disasters and banking crises and a whole bunch of other stuff you saw at the White House, they could literally have you just talk about the last 15 years of your career, and I guarantee you, you'd have a Nielsen-rated show that everybody will watch. So thank you for your service to the country, and thank you for sharing your story on Protégé Podcast.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me.
What a journey Melanie Newman has had thus far in her career. So much history she's witnessed as a crisis communications expert. So let's see what we can learn and apply in our own careers on The Breakdown. All right, there are two concepts that are both distinctive and related that we want to talk about on The Breakdown that I think Melanie's career has in many ways evidenced. One is leaning in to the moment. And number two is the power of mentors. So Sheryl Sandberg, who's the COO of Facebook, wrote a book called Lean In, and it was a guide for women executives to lean into the great challenges and strategies in their organizations. Literally, it's a posture of leaning toward the problem, not shrinking from it. Another expression people will say is run to the fire, run toward the fire. And I want to talk a little bit about what that means, because many times in our career, we will try to operate and act in the workplace where we are trying not to make a mistake. We are trying to not screw up. We are unconsciously risk averse, and we don't run toward the challenge. We run away from it, and we unconsciously look at it as risky. What if I mess this up? I'll never get fired if I don't, you know, make a gigantic mistake. We are essentially playing defense in our careers. And we think that's going to allow us to survive in the workplace. But one, that is no insurance against getting fired. And two, it is absolutely the wrong ingredient to get you promoted, right? Because you have to put together a body of work a series of wins that allow you to show your boss or senior management that you are ready for more complex challenges. And if you can't deal with what's come across your desk in the early part of your career, or the middle part of your career, senior management is going to be a little bit too much for you to deal with. So you have to have these stories, these moments, these incidents, these projects that you've managed. And the only way you're going to win is if you get in the game. The only way you're going to be able to tell what you did in the BP oil crisis, or what you did with this embattled congressman, or what happened during the election, is to be in the moment and to lean into these challenges. So the takeaway is, raise your hand for the tough projects. Raise your hand for the overseas assignments. Raise your hand for the problems the company or organization is facing that seems intractable, seems problematic, seems like it's never, ever going to be solved. Be the person that raises your hand for that, because when you succeed, you're going to have an incredible body of work to show to get you to that next level. And if you fail, you are still going to get credit for leaning in. I have seen this happen. I've seen conversations about succession planning at senior management where people have run into the fire. They have leaned into problematic situations that nobody could solve, and they didn't solve it, but maybe they did better than everybody else. Or in some cases, they still spectacularly failed. They get credit for evidencing the leadership and the confidence to lean into the problem, to run into the fire, the courage, the confidence to put the organization first. That's a trait that will always serve you well. The second part of the breakdown is about the value of mentors. The value of mentors. And it's related to leaning into these problems in the workplace. So Melanie Newman, not yet 40, has the following people as mentors: the former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Sean Donovan, the U.S. Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, and undoubtedly, there are others on the White House staff. She didn't go into it, but I'm sure the White House communications staff, people in the White House policy office. Anytime you're a superstar in this environment, people take notice and recognize you. So Melanie has these mentors now who are going to endorse her, who are going to be references for her, who are going to put their equity on the line to recommend her for incredible jobs for this next stage of her career. Why are they going to do that? Out of loyalty? No, she doesn't work for the administration anymore. All these people are going their separate ways. The reason there's going to be this loyalty from these very powerful people in her career is because they saw her lean in. They saw her take on the tough challenges, and I'm sure her track record wasn't 100%. Everybody makes mistakes. But when your boss sees you run into the fire, sees you raise your hand for the tough assignments, sees you take on the problems that for years have bedeviled the organization, and you're going to try to crack the code, that gives tremendous confidence to the senior manager. It gives tremendous faith in your boss that your leadership, that your capability and capacity, that somehow you are going to not only raise your hand to solve the problem, but in most cases, you're going to figure it out. And so it lets the senior manager operate in ambiguity, knowing that they have a team of people, or at least one person in you, that is capable of helping them solve some of these ambiguous situations. And that's what many people who leave middle management and go into senior management fail to appreciate. In senior management, it is operating in ambiguity. Whether you're in finance or legal or marketing or sales, you're going to have to solve problems with incomplete, insufficient information that's fraught with all kinds of risk. And so as a senior leader, you can't do that by yourself. You need somebody to bounce ideas off of. You need somebody to walk into your own fire with. And who are you going to take? The person that has history walking into the fire in their own world, the person that's leaned in before. And so develop that trait, develop that capacity to get the confidence of your mentor. It will pay off in spades for the rest of your career. These two points are interrelated. It's like in basketball. The coach doesn't necessarily want to know who can make the shot when the game is on the line. That's certainly important, but a really important consideration is who wants the ball? Who's asking, pass it to me? You'll watch basketball and you'll see players shrink when the moment comes. They'll shrink. They'll sort of stop moving, or they'll otherwise not be available. Somebody is raising their hand saying, give me the ball. LeBron James does that. Steph Curry does that. Michael Jordan did that. Give me the ball when the game is on the line. I will make the shot. That is as equally, if not more important, than your capacity to actually make the shot. It's showing the coach that you're willing to lean in and embrace the moment. And that's what we're talking about. That is an indescribably powerful attribute to have as a leader. When you get to senior management and things are ambiguous, it'll be the people that lean in that solve the problems. It'll be the people that say, pass me the ball, coach. I'm ready to take the shot. Thank you for tuning in to Protégé Podcast. Please check us out on social media at Protégé Podcast on Facebook and Instagram, and let us know your thoughts on topics we can cover on the next Protégé Podcast.